Session number 27052.
Mr. Franklin, rail 5. We were talking about your time at HMS Excellent. You were saying you did these commando courses. I mean, did you find all this generally very tough?
Very
tough.
Oh yeah, yes, it was hard going, but it was just something we had to do. It was all part of the gunnery course, but the idea was to toughen us up because they knew the war in Europe was getting close to an end, and we would be needed to, if they went to Japan, we would be required probably to help out with the troops, go ashore and become Royal Naval Commandos, really. That's what we were more or less trained as, a Royal Naval Commando.
So what happened next then? The course was not that long, was it? It was July to September.
Yeah. Yes, it was about that distance of time, was it, July?
And then you seem to have gone back to the Victory.
Then you go back to Victory, which is now called Nelson. And you waited then for another draft chit, as we called them.
And anything happened? You were there about 3 months.
Yes, we were there. We're just kicking our heels for that period of time, going to divisions on parade ground and general, just keeping us on our toes type of thing. You know, we were just going to divisions and doing some more square bashing from time to time. Sometimes go to type of classes and talks that they give you. You know, you get these talks. One thing about Portsmouth Barracks was while you were in there, you were never allowed to walk across the playground. You always had to double. Never walk. If you were caught walking, you'd hear a big bellow from somewhere, from the jaunty, as we called him. That was the chief petty officer who would be somewhere around. A big roar coming. You'd have to get on the move. You were never allowed to walk across the parade ground in Portsmouth in Victory. And we just, from day to day, went ashore, as we called it, and down the town, kicked our heels until we got the next draft chit.
What was that draft to?
HMS Dean.
Now where did you join her? That was in December.
That was in, December 44. 4th of December, I believe it was, 44.
And where was she?
She was in Pollock Dock.
Which is?
Belfast. Yeah, Belfast, Northern Ireland. Oh, we were went by train. We were given a travel warrant. We went by train. I think I don't know how long it took us, actually. Quite a long train journey up to there. To we went to Stranraer by train to Stranraer, and caught the ferry across to Larne, and then another train to Belfast. And this Pollock Dock is only about 150 yards from the station, actually. I think it's called Victoria Station we came into at Belfast. And you just join the ship, report to the buffer there, or the chief petty officer on board.
Now, what were your first impressions of HMS Dean? Because it's very different from your previous...
Very, very... I thought she looked very small to the after coming off the Nelson, but I'd been... We'd been told that the small ships were better and not so much red tape, because on board a battleship, it's very red taped. Everything is done by the book. You do everything by the book. And then I was allocated a mess. And then...
You were joined as naval seaman gunner, weren't you?
Yes, I went there, joined the dean as an anti-aircraft gunner, third class.
Now, What was your mess deck like, and where was it? What can you describe it?
Yes, the mess deck. That's just how can you call it? Like a cabin with the first mess I went on to was the seamer's mess, which had about, I think, 25, 30 men on it. It's fitted with long tables and forms that went along, which were fixed to the deck. The first impression of her was, in actual fact, my mess deck, the seaman's mess, there was, which was amazing, it had its laundry. It had a laundry on board, so you could get blankets washed. I think they charged her about three pence at that time to wash a blanket. And it had a cold water dispenser, but that had been taken out of action because that wasn't the type of thing the Navy wanted. They felt that was a bit too soft for, I think, for the Royal Navy.
Now, you haven't mentioned the bunks at all.
Yeah, the bunks. We had bunks that were fixed by chains onto the bulkhead, and there were three, the top, middle and bottom bunk. And once you'd, when you got up in the morning, they were pushed up against the bulkhead and hooked back so as it gave room to manoeuvre about. At night, you had to turn in, you let the bunks down, and they were all on chains, which was quite different from having to sling your hammock all the time.
So which did you prefer?
Well, personally, I used to like the hammock, but it seemed that it was a change at the time, and you had a bit more, seemed to have a bit more room, although if you had, if you had someone who was a bit fidgety and that sort of thing, and forever moving around, it used to get more disturbed than if you were in a hammock. Because if you were in the bottom bunk, you'd have someone that had to tread down on your bunk to get out and use your bunk. You didn't have ladders to get up into them. They just had one bunk, two bunks and onto the top. So I always made a point, if possible, to grab a top bunk. So I thought I could get a good sleep. I didn't mind disturbing the other two as long as I was all right.
So what were your duties going to be on the Dean? Were you on one of the guns, the Oerlikons?
Well, that was... I was a lookout at action stations.
Tell us about that, then. What was the duty as a lookout?
Well, you went onto the bridge. You spent 4 hours on bridge as lookout. And you had a pair of binoculars and you looked for lights, periscopes, if any, you could see them, you know, floating and coming, going along in the sea. You could see periscopes if there was one above the water because it used to make a little fluorescent light from the salt water if a submarine was moving along. And also, you used to, anything you saw, you had to shout to the officer who was normally on, who was on deck there, who was navigating the ship more or less, and you tell him that green 40, or green 30, green 40, green 50, green 90, that there was a light bearing green 90 or green 45, and if you saw a light, you would see these. Boys, flashing boys that you would have to report and all that sort of thing. They had to all be reported.
Did you use binoculars or...?
Yes, we had binoculars all the time. They were very powerful binoculars.
What was that your only action stations? Were you always on the bridge or were you sometimes...
On action stations, I went onto the bridge always.
Never in the cruiser?
Every time we were called.
Now, except what about your cruising stations?
Cruising station... I was... quartermaster on board, which was steering the ship.
Tell me about that. That's on the bridge again?
No, that was just below the bridge.
The
wheelhouse. We were in the wheelhouse. And we were unusual to it. It appears that we had the spoke. We had the spoke and the ordinary old-type steering wheel. And you had a compass in front of you, magnetic compass. And you will get, and the voice pipes coming down to you, and the skipper who was up on the bridge, or whoever was the first lieutenant or the officer of the watch who was on the bridge, he would give you a cautious steer. So if he'd say quarter mile steer or change course to 3-4-0 or 1-4-0 or 1-5, whichever course you had to steer, and then you, when you got to that, you would report back 1-4-0 or whichever, you know, whichever was required. And you held on that course. He would say, steer, you know, hold that course, and you would steer that course.
Was it easy enough to do that? Was it easy enough to do that?
It was to me. It depended how rough a sea got. If a sea got very rough, you could easily have started chasing your compass. And if you chase the compass, you'll then send the ship all over the place.
What do you mean by chasing the compass?
Well, you've got... On the compass, it shows you the head of the ship. There's a mark, which is the head of the ship. And then the compass moves backwards and forwards by that. It's a gyro compass, which continuously goes round. And I say can moves whenever you move the ship. You move the ship's head in line with the degrees that they want to steer on the compass. And if you start swinging around, if you didn't have the knack, or whatever, for a better word, or the ability to hold the ship where it should be. I mean, you would see, if you saw it start to drift, you would just ease your wheel back until you made sure that you kept on that line, and God help you if you didn't. It seemed to let you know if you were going off course. Otherwise, you know, they say, you'd zigzag all over the place. The idea was to keep on that course set that you were set on continuously and not move off of it. But you would learn, after a period on the wheel of a ship, you learn when to start bringing the wheel back if it's starting to drift, depending with currents, tides, or wind, because you get the wind blowing against the ship, will make it drift off course if you don't bring it back. So you had to keep on that, steer on that course all the time. As I say, you would certainly know if you come off of it, there'd be a hell of a bellow from up top, and you watch it, ask it what you were up to. So do you... I suppose the discipline taught you, you did exactly as you were told, you know. That was the best thing to do. We used to do 4 hours on, 4 hours off.
Was it the normal watch system?
Yeah, dog watches, four on, four off. And,
Now, how did you settle into the ship? I mean, how did you get on with the lads?
Oh, I got on quite well with them. I was, one of the smallest, I think, on board at the time, one of the shortest anyway. You get nicknamed Shorty. And I used to talk a lot, as I'm doing at the moment. And you used to get nicknames, but I got on quite well with most of them. I never had... You always had an oppo, someone you befriended. So a couple of you went to shore together when you came into harbour.
Do you remember who your oppo was?
I had one oppo, his name was Les, but I can't remember his surname, and I still owe him £10, which I borrowed off him when we went up to London once. I didn't go home on leave, because we stayed in London instead, in the Union Jack Club at outside Waterloo Station. I said to him, I'm not going any further, I'm going to stop here. So he said, well, I'll stop here with you. I said, we'll have a few days in London. And I went down to Brixton and visited my sister, who lived in Brixton at the time. And
I'll come back to that. We're talking about your oppo. So why did you get on with him so well?
Well, we just got on, you know. He liked doing the things that I did. That was going round, chatting up the birds, and going having a drink and a meal and that sort of thing, you know. And
now, how were the petty officers on your...
Most of them were very good. The buffer, as we called him, he was the one who gave you all your work to do when you went on, you know, if you were watchkeeping, you didn't get involved with him very much. You just carried on your job as a watchkeeper. So I made a point of always being a watchkeeper. I always, if I went aboard ship, I would say I can do a quartermaster's job. And they'd say, OK, do you want to do that? Do you want to go watchkeeping? So you go watchkeeping. They did give you, more or less, give you a choice if they thought you had the ability. So,
so you didn't have much to do with the petty officers then?
Not lots. I just the only time you was when you if you were in trouble, if you were late back aboard, you would then they would tell you to get your cap and you'd they'd take you before the first lieutenant or whoever was in charge on board at that time, the duty officer, the officer of the watch, he was called actually, and he would say, "Well, I'd put you on a charge to see the captain next day or whichever day they decided," and you would see, you would have the captain see defaulters then each day. They would have a defaulters, and it'd dish you out if you were. It depends what you're on. I mean, if you were a few minutes late aboard than you should have been, or you'd lost part of your gear, a kit, or your cap, or something, you would probably get about 3 days number 11s, which would be different tasks they would give you to do. They'd make you clean the heads, as they called the toilets, they were called the heads. You'd have jobs like that to do as a punishment for, and you weren't allowed ashore. If you were a defaulter, you weren't allowed ashore.
And did you have this happen to you?
Did it
happen to you?
Oh, yes, I'd had defaulters a few times.
For being laid back?
No, never for being laid back. Normally for insubordination. Which was sometimes a slip of the tongue, you know, you'd turn around. Sometimes they would be very friendly with you, like a petty officer, although most of the time you were in charge of a killick, a leading seaman. But if a buffer said something and you thought, oh, he's a nice guy, and you turn around and say something a bit facetious, he probably, if he felt had a bad day or something and had a bad night ashore or something, he'd probably run you for it, and you'd end up with jankers, you know, as we called them.
Now, what did you think of the officers?
Most of the officers were very, very good. Well, they were aboard us. We had a very happy ship. The Dean was a very happy ship. And
was that down to the officers, you think?
Oh, I think it was down to
why?
The...
Well,
I think some captains wanted a happy ship, others wanted to... once so much they did want a happy ship, but all officers want a happy ship, because with a happy ship, you had an efficient ship. When men are happy, they work efficiently and they get on with what they're given to do.
And you think it's the officers that set the tone?
Sorry?
The officers set the tone?
Oh, yes. I think from... The first lieutenant is the one that sets the tone on all ships. He was the chap, one down from the captain.
Do you remember any of them in particular, the officers, on the Dean?
Not offhand. They were there, and we just... most of the time, it was the petty officers. I was very bad at names, still are very bad at remembering names. I'm still very much, very bad at remembering names.
Now, the first duty you seem to have been on, according to the book, was you went on an Atlantic... Well, you went to meet an Atlantic convoy in
Yes,
December,
we went out and picked
halfway
up...
through December, yeah.
Yes, we went out and picked up a convoy about halfway out in the Atlantic. What used to happen, the Canadians brought them so far, and then we picked them up and brought them the rest of the way in. It used to be the Canadian Navy used to come about halfway, and we'd go out about halfway and pick them up and bring them back into Belfast, Liverpool, wherever they were... going.
Now, that convoy in mid-December seems to have been quite noticeable for a couple of reasons. Well, the first is it was very bad weather, and the Dean seems to have been quite badly damaged.
Yeah, we were. We got the hedgehogs broke loose, were floating all over the place. But they don't explode unless they're primed. They have to be primed first before anything can happen to them. But I think at one time we had some... depth charges break loose, and they were going around a deck like steamroller, smashing against everything, and they can do a tremendous amount of damage. But they won't explode unless they're, fuse is set in them.
Now, it didn't make you ill at all, though?
Pardon?
It didn't make you ill at all?
No, I was never seasick. I had a captain who was always seasick when he went to sea, because I remember, because the captain always had what we called a captain's flunky. And he used to look after the captain, you know, like his, what they call them, Like the army have a batman for there. He was used to look after that. We used to call him Captain Flunky, Flunky or Flunky. And he used to say, Captain Officer is having a bad day. And if it was very rough, he would be very seasick.
Well, you weren't anymore.
I was very lucky. I never felt seasickness. I don't know why. I became very, I quickly came acclimatised to the sea. I'd hadn't been to sea before, so I was quite surprised that I was able to get away with it. But some of the lads were very, very seasick. We used to get quite a few, even to the extent that some used to have to be taken off of to duty on these small ships because they just couldn't, because they used to roll to 45 degrees. I mean, I've always had my nose in the water sometimes when we were in very rough seas, when I'd been on lookout, you know, when we were in convoy or that.
The rolling was really, it was noticeably worse than most ships.
On the smaller ship, it was on that. They were flat bottom almost, and they would almost roll on grass, wet grass. They were so easy to, they rolled like anything. I mean, I've known them to be over almost, you know, almost that angle, tremendous, a tremendous angle.
And you had to go to Devonport for some, just a bit of repairs. You left this convoy, do you remember that?
Yes, I had to, was that before my time? No, I never went into Devonport, so.
Well, this was December.
Yeah, late December. Yeah, well, yes, we did call into a harbour. I never remember which harbour it was, to tell you the honest truth.
And then the next thing is that there was an attack on a submarine that turned out to be British. Do you remember that?
Oh, that was when they left. They left harbour and they got a contact.
What do you mean they? Not you?
Pardon?
Not you.
They, that means the ship, rather. You know, that's the Aztec.
You weren't on board?
I don't think I was on board at that time. I think it was just after that, when she went back to Belfast, after leaving there. She was heading for Belfast at that time. And what happened is that they attacked a British submarine. And I remember talking about it when I went aboard. So that must have been before I joined her.
Right.
But they attacked this submarine and were called back into harbour, weren't they? I remember them talking about it. It came to the surface. But the trouble was, they said, that the escort who should have been with it on the trials was non-station or something. And so she was... If there was a submarine and there was no escort with it on trials, it was fair game to attack it, because unless it give a signal that it was friendly and not enemy, then you just attacked it. So they were very lucky. They weren't finished off. But it was just after that I joined her.
So you didn't join until the back end of December, nearer January then?
It must have been, because... I thought, see, my record says I joined her on the 4th of December. I remember going and joining her up there, but I could have been on Caroline, which was the depot ship, for a week or so before she...
That would explain it.
Yeah, I could have been on Caroline before that happened. So that was the depot ship.
Now, so what were you doing on the Dean then? What was the Dean up to? It seems to have been on anti-submarine patrols.
Yes, we used to do submarine patrols, which they split in. There were six ships, which split into two groups of three, and they patrolled at about, oh, I suppose, a mile and a half to 2 miles apart, something like that. You could see the other one, you know, and they patrolled three abreast, and they covered tight squares. And patrol like
and whereabouts there. Were you doing this?
This was all, well, in several places. You'd either go off the west coast of Ireland, you'd go through the Minches, and between the Scottish Islands, you'd patrol through there. You'd go down the Irish Sea, and you'd go down to the south of Ireland and patrol an area there. We even went as far down as... through into the Channel and into out as far as the Channel Islands.
And what were these anti-submarine patrols like? What was it like to be out on them?
A bit monotonous. You'd go up and down, up and down. It was only when you actually got... you were called to action stations that you felt you were doing something. The rest of the time, you were going, just patrolling up and down, up and down. I mean, you were going miles and miles one way, and then you'd take another square and you'd patrol that.
Now, you seem to have got a submarine with the Con and the Rupert on the 27th of March. I don't know whether anything happened before that, you recall.
No, nothing really. As I say, we're continuously on patrol. We used to go and do convoy run with convoys and bring them in. And then you'd go off again on patrol, and then you'd go out and get called perhaps to pick up another convoy and spring that in, and then you go back on the monotony of the patrol again, you know, just covering the areas where it thought the submarines may be. Because we got a lot of information, because after they got the... what's the name of that thing they captured? They captured
the
code.
Enigma stuff, yeah.
Yeah, they captured the Enigma. So they were getting a lot of information of where the ships were, where the submarines were, where they were, you know, when they were leaving, where they were heading, and where they were reporting back, and they were picking up the signals. And they were able to read them and know exactly where their areas were, because what they did by... the areas the ships give is by longitude and latitude. And, you know, they're so far... and they had, on the charts, that points them out to you where exactly where they would be. So you would patrol that area where they were reported to be heading for and hope to pick them up.
Now, you seem to have been involved in two submarine sinkings, U-boat sinkings. One was the U-965 on the 27th of March. That was with the Con and the Rupert. Do you remember that at all?
Yes, I remember going into that attack.
What do you see? What happened?
Well, what is it? You go in, you hear them go in, they decide to do a 10-charge pattern, which is two at the back, and then two out the side, two at the back, two out the side, two out the back, two out the back, roll them off, two off the back, and then they fired these depth charge throwers, which was a massive amount of water. It depends how low they were just set. If they were set for a low depth, you didn't get so much. But if they were at a shallow depth, the water went sky high. But also we'd done attacks with hedgehogs, which they were called. They were on the front, sprocket bombs, and they were fired over the bows. And when they fired them, they used to have to slow the ship down, because if you went through them and they hit something, they'd... they didn't do the ship any good, almost blow you out of the water. There were times when we attacked short of fish.
Stick to the U-965. What happened on that particular occasion, the first one, which you sank with the Con and the Rupert?
Oh, that was...
it was off the Cape Wrath.
Yeah, off Cape Wrath. That was where they picked up... I'm sure they picked up... I remember them saying they'd picked up several bits and pieces. We didn't do the picking up. Con done the picking up. They picked up the life belts and bits and pieces, you know.
Did was there much to see in this sinking, or was it just dropping depth charges and hedgehogs and then that was it?
Well, you dropped depth charges and then you stopped and went back and you looked out. The lookouts were looking for, as I very often I had to report, a sea oil patch. And you'd report an oil patch where probably the fuel tanks on the submarine had split and burst, and it would send oil up. But I believe that some of the submarines used to jettison flotsam and what have you to make it look as if it had been sunk, and they could just creep away then quite easily. So, but the only way this was confirmed was where they got the report back from Germany after the war, where we could confirm a lot of submarines were sunk. I mean, some were sunk and the ships weren't given the credit, but they were after the war, they were able to confirm that certain ships had sunk submarines.
So you didn't know particularly at the time?
They weren't 100% sure. You got all this oil and that, and they lose contact because... keep contact and it's in one position on the bottom of the sea, so...